The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week is a man with more used cars than he has space on his driveway. It's James Baggett.
That is true. I have got more used cars than I have space for, but that is a good thing, John, because it means I have some stock.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that's still quite a low number, you know.
Yeah, it's two cars. And hopefully one less today, because I took a deposit on the Qashqai on Wednesday, so he's come to see it at 2:30 today. So fingers crossed there's a sale there.
It's all go
in the world of setting up a AI-powered car dealership. We've had a bit of a week though, John, haven't we? Because you've helped me a little bit with this week. And we went to buy another vehicle for stock. I'd purchased it from CarWow via an auction. It was a Mazda 6 Tourer, rather leggy, 126,000 miles, but full service history, looked very nice in the pictures. So you were down, weren't you, for some photos of something else, and you took me up to Morden in South London on Wednesday morning to meet Ivan, who did turn out to be terrible, because we looked at the over the car, didn't we, and it was in no way as described in the pictures. He said the wheels were in perfect condition. Every single one of them was curbed. He said the tyres were in great condition. Two rear tyres had big chunks gouged out of them, which needed replacing. He'd said that there were a few chips on it and scratches. Every panel was chipped or scratched in some way, shape or form, wasn't it? And then the big one for me was we looked under the bonnet, checked the oil. It was a little bit low. And he said, oh, yeah, the oil light came on this morning. Yeah, a likely story. Yay. So it's sort of at that point we didn't test drive it. I'd really prepared properly. I'd use this the DMS I'm using, which is dealer kit, to give me a PDI form and an appraisal form, and I printed out all the details, and I really didn't want to get caught out, and I was going around the car, and in the end I had to say to him before I even took it out for test drive, I'm not going to be able to pay you what I'd bid for this car, because I've already seen about £500 or £600 worth of things that I need to fix on it. And at that point, you could see his face drop. And it was the sort of moral of the story was I was obviously keen on buying that car. I needed some stock, and actually walking away from it was definitely the right thing to do. Would I have done that if you hadn't have been there with me, John? Is a question.
Oh, no, me saying walk away.
Yeah,
because I think the problem lies, James, in that you were sort of balanced between wanting to walk away, but also not wanting to get on the train to go home.
That is true. Yeah, that is
so
true.
So I'm glad I could persuade you to do, you know, the latter.
I think what it taught us, it does show you, though, doesn't it, that it's not easy. Buying and selling used cars is not easy in any way. And actually, you could do as much due diligence as possible in advance. And we certainly did that when we were looking at all of this stuff. I asked them via CarWow to send me loads of other pictures. I'd really checked. And still, when I turned it up, it wasn't as described. But yeah, I suppose that's, you know, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it, wouldn't they?
What I took away from that, and sorry, CarWow, if you're listening, but what I took away from that is how brilliant auctions are. Because you turn up, as we did with Jamie the other week, you turn up, there are 150 cars going through. They've all been appraised in exactly the same way by someone who knows what they're doing, relatively speaking. You can see if it's got any scratches, they're all measured, blah, blah, blah. It's had some sort of check to go through. Does the sat nav work? Does all this sort of stuff work? What we had to do was do all of that in person ourselves. And that was your entire day wasted, really, not buying one car. Whereas you could have, if you turned up to an auction and somehow that had slipped through the net, you'd have just gone, oh, don't worry, I'll have the next one. And you'd have something else.
I did use a train journey effectively and bought a Ford Fiesta on the way home. So I mean, it's not every cloud. But well, I think we should probably introduce our guest, who is he's probably not used to having to buy and sell £3,000 Mazda 6s.
Yeah, I don't think this is probably an issue in his world. So our guest this week is Tom Giaconelli from Romans International. Tom, welcome. Have you ever bought a Mazda 6 diesel from South London?
I have not, but it's interesting how familiar it all sounds. Even in our sector of the market, we have all those same problems, going buying, selling cars, people misdescribing them, walking away from cars. It does happen in our sector just as much, I think.
Someone was telling me, Tom, the other day, that they sort of beat themselves up when they don't buy the car. They sort of think about that more than when they actually do buy the car. I mean, do you feel the same way?
Yeah, because you get the whole excitement when you've agreed a deal, then, you know, as they do, everyone's car's mint, they tell you, and then you go up and it's just so disappointing and frustrating when you get there. And it's like, as you said, with that car, we have that so often. It's, you know, it needs a tire, needs paint. It's mainly paint is the thing that people can't describe very well. And, you know, with the kind of cars we sell, we do have extremely high standards. So, you know, what our standard is to someone else thinks, well, it's 10,000 miles. It's, you know, it should have a few chips on it. But we're like, well, no, it's still 200 grand. It needs to look almost like new. So, but yeah, it can be very frustrating. And it's a massive waste of time, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I'm certainly learning that. Well, I mean, Tom, we've seen you a few times, we've been up and done a video, but there will be people listening to the podcast who might not have heard of your business, so maybe we could just tell them a little bit about it.
Sure, yeah. So I'm down here at Romans International in Surrey. We are a independent supercar dealership, deal with mainly the sort of latest stuff, the rarest stuff, anything from Bugatti Veyron we've got in the showroom at the moment, all the way down to, got a couple of electric Abarths at the moment, which was a questionable buy, but we've got a couple of those as well at the moment.
We were talking about those, funny enough, the other night. They're how they make they kind of generate a noise, don't they? That sounds like a normal engine. So what else have you got? What else have you got in the showroom, Tom? And what's hot at the moment in the supercar world?
So we've got the hypercars from 918. Spiders, McLaren P1, just got a Ferrari F12 TDF that arrived this morning. So that kind of stuff. But yeah, if you go on our forecourt, it's full of SUVs, Range Rovers, G-Wagons, and, you know, being in the midst of winter, it's those cars really that are hot at the moment. We are getting, like, it's definitely picked up, we found in January, and we're getting quite a lot of interest now in stuff. Some stuff we've had in stock since the back end of last summer. So we've sold a couple of Ferrari 812 super fast. I think with everything dropping in value, there's a new kind of enthusiasm in the market at the moment, because everything looks such good value compared to what it was, you know, 6-9 months ago.
Yeah, how is that? And how has that drops in value affected your end of the market? Has it been as severe as we've seen in other areas?
It's probably been more severe, because everything was so crazy for a couple of years, and everything was so overinflated. You know, Porsche product was massively overlist for the most mainstream models, and that has had a huge adjustment. So it's been painful, you know, lots of painful conversations with customers that bought cars at the peak who are now looking to sell them and are losing big amounts of money. You know, we've been caught out ourselves with a couple that we just had in stock too long and couldn't quite sell them before they kept going down and down and down. It seems to have steadied a bit. There is some stuff that's still dropping, but it definitely feels like people are seeing the value now at the new levels.
They're very difficult conversations, aren't they, to have with people who are buying those sorts of cars, and we're talking big sums of money that these people are losing. How do you manage those expectations, and how do you explain it? Because, you know, you want another deal out of them, don't you? I mean, it must be really, really difficult to have those chats.
It is. And, you know, some people take it differently. And in terms of, some people totally understand that's the way the market was. You know, you didn't force me to buy it. That's where they were at that point. I wanted it. So we don't really get the blame, but there are obviously some people who are going to feel a bit bitter having bought a car and you know, some of them are losing 70, 80 grand on a car they've only done 1,000, 2,000 miles in. But, you know, it was the way it was. And today, most people understand the kind of outside factors. It's not like we overcharged them then and now we're kicking them in the nuts. It's just the way the market, you know, we don't dictate the market.
Do you think it will come back for some of these cars? I mean, you've got, as we move closer and closer to the 2035 ban, do you think some of the stuff that they're especially producing now or recently produced, the stuff that isn't turbocharged or stuff that is not hybrid in any way, do you think they're going to become more desirable as we get closer to that ban?
What James is asking there is, will his 911 go up in value?
Funny you should say that, but yeah, I suppose it's slightly linked, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a stronger following for the more pure cars. You know, there's always going to be a following for the latest thing, whether it's hybrid or fully electric. There's always going to be demand for what's the freshest thing out. But yeah, we've already noticed it slightly starting to bounce back a bit on some cars, where people think they possibly bottomed out a little bit, and now they're just firming up again. I mean, I think with interest rates still being high, insurance premiums still being fairly high on a lot of these cars, I don't think we're going to see a big bounce back just yet. But I think when interest rates do start to come down, you could certainly see that. And long term, yes, I think the older cars, especially, you know, some of the more sort of analog cars, you know, some of the older cars from maybe 10, 20 years ago, definitely as you get closer, they're going to become more of a treasure that you just are not going to find anymore. So they will have a strong following.
And how are buyers reacting to some of the newer stuff? I mean, I heard on the grapevine that the cars like the 296, Ferrari 296, it's a hybrid setup, isn't it? It wasn't quite as popular with buyers. Is that something you've found?
I think the 296, the customers we know that have got them, who are, you know, big collectors and have had everything, absolutely rave about them. They genuinely think, despite being a hybrid, they think it's an incredible driver's car. I think the problem with them is they made too many, they were too easy to get hold of, they've lost a lot of value, so people are a bit scared of them. And that's the negativity, but the actual car is brilliant, and you know, I don't think it can really be faulted. And you know, even better than the SF90, that's a lot more money and came before it. People are really sort of saying that 296, just drive one, because it is a seriously good car.
Yeah, I drove one at Goodwood when they had an open day, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I think the most important thing about that is it sounded incredible. It's got that beautiful Ferrari sound back that was sort of lost with the turbocharged V8s, I found.
Yeah,
but I was interested to hear what you had to say on that front. The other thing I wanted to mention is you did very well in our used car awards, didn't you, 2023?
Yes.
You picked up the Specialist Used Car Dealership Award and also the use of video. And you invest a lot of your own time, don't you, in creating those videos? And they're incredibly popular. Do you enjoy doing them?
I do enjoy doing them, and they're good for business. They're good to get us sort of out there in a different way. And we always say, you know, one Instagram post, someone's going to look at it for 2 or 3 seconds. With a YouTube video, you're going to get potentially 10, 20 minutes of someone's time, which has massive value. And actually what we're saying, you know, we do it in a way where we're not trying to sell so much. We're just trying to be informative, giving, you know, an opinion and giving an insight to these cars, which is not easy to sort of get out there in the sort of video space. So yeah, I really enjoyed doing it. I mean, love talking about these cars, they're so interesting. It's just finding the time is the biggest challenge.
Yeah, no, I know how long it takes to do video, that's for sure. And when it comes to your outlook for the rest of this year, you've sort of touched on it, but what do you think is going to happen in the market in general, and also specifically in your area as we go forward in 2024?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing some positive shoots, and we're pretty encouraged by the year so far, how it started. You know, there's some great cars coming out this year, which I'm sure we're going to be excited to get our hands on. But yeah, I think, you know, interest rates is still a sort of factor, but I do think people are sort of getting around or getting used to it being high, and also the fact that the values have come down so much that the actual higher interest is pretty menial compared to what you saved on the depreciation. So yeah, we're feeling pretty positive. You know, things are a bit more back to normal, I would say, which, you know, I think takes a lot of the kind of, what's the right word? I don't know. There's a lot of people that come into our market thinking, how easy is this? Cars are going up in value. I can buy anything and sell it and make a profit. And it was a bit like that for a couple of years. But the fact is, people are getting, you know, traders and dealers are getting a bit caught out, a little bit more cautious, makes it slightly easier for people like us that have been around a lot longer, have got sort of a bit, you know, we're more well known. I think people trust us. Whereas these kind of people that have appeared out of nowhere who have been successful for a couple of years are sort of now taking a back seat and allowing the kind of the bigger players to do it. So yeah, we think it's looking good.
You mentioned some exciting cars you're looking forward to. What are you looking forward to this year?
I guess the ones we're most looking forward to, there's the new 911 ST, which we're starting to get quite close to getting one. That's the sort of GT3 RS without a wing, manual gearbox. That's got, you know, all the enthusiasts going a bit crazy. So we're excited to get one of those. The SF90 XX is going to be a really, really hot car. You know, we hopefully might get one of these Gordon Murray hypercars. And yeah, there's also going to be more run-of-the-mill stuff. I know there's obviously yesterday got announced the new Macan, Porsche Macan, yes. EV. I know the Lamborghini are bringing out a hybrid version of the Urus. The Range Rover Electric might come out. So those are all cars that I'm sure we'll get quite a few of.
And how hot is the Ferrari Purosangue? If I've said that right, I can never actually tell whether I've said it right.
I think that's how to pronounce it. Some people call it the Purosangue or something, but yeah, that is a hot car. We are getting offered quite a few, and people want big money for them. So I'm not sure they're going to hold these big premiums at the moment. And a lot of people are a bit sensitive about selling them because they don't want them advertised, because they'll get into trouble with Ferrari, blah blah blah. But yeah, there's a few knocking about, and they're making quite a few. So I think it's a hot car. People are paying big money for them now, but I do think by the end of the year, they'll sort of, you know, the hype would have worn off a bit.
Most of them I saw on Auto Trader are up for about £500,000, which is double a Rolls Royce, isn't it?
It doesn't really make sense why they're so much. I mean, it's a new Ferrari, and it's the first time they've done an SUV, if we're allowed to call it that. But it's, it just doesn't stack up how much, especially with those premiums. I think they list it, most of them list around 400, 450. So once you've added £100,000 premium, which people are doing, it's just crazy money.
Yeah. Have you bought any?
We've got one coming, which we were involved in speccing it from new, which comes, I think, in the summer. But it's one that we're probably going to keep. I imagine my dad's going to want to drive it and use it.
Is it green?
It is green, yeah. Green. So, yeah, that's what he's saying. That's going to be his final car before he retires. But we'll see.
We'll see, yeah. I'm sure you've heard that before.
I've definitely heard that before, yeah.
Right, let's crack on, shall we, John?
Okie dokie. So James and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week, and at the end, Tom is going to decide who chose the best ones and who is the winner. James won again last week, so go on, get on with it.
Thank you, John. That's very kind of you. I am going to start with a story that we have just published a few moments ago, and this is news that the FCA is effectively banning car dealers from selling gap insurance from February onwards. So I started getting inklings of this about lunchtime yesterday. And I think what had happened is some communications had gone out from some of these insurance providers that provide gap two car dealers. And obviously when these sorts of things happen, my phone rings and people sort of say, have you heard this? Which is brilliant. Thank you for the people who do that, because that is a great way to get stories. But yeah, so we spoke to the FCA. So I sent an email across to the FCA and said, are you going to be banning gap insurance? Very, very quickly, my phone rang with the press officer from the FCA. And you always know when you speak to a big agency like that, if you get a phone call very quickly, it either means definitely not true or it's definitely true. And he said, what have you been told? And I said, well, it's the fact that gap insurance is being banned by the FCA. That's what had been told at that point in time. And he said, oh, what, in words as crude as those? And I said, yeah. Yes, exactly, words as crude as those. He said, well, we will come back to you with a comment tomorrow. And they have come back to us with a comment, which says they are they're disappointed, they say, with the market's response to warnings to improve the value of gap insurance for customers. I don't need to tell our listeners what gap insurance is, but obviously it covers the gap between the price paid for the vehicle and how much is remaining on finance if in the event of a total loss, and covers that bit in between. The thing that the FCA have got an issue with is the fact that dealers make considerable profits on these. They can add as much as 50% commission on these insurance products. And I think the FCA are worried that that commission fee isn't giving consumers fair value for money. And I think it's very hard to argue that, you know, a 50% commission is a big markup, isn't it? So we know how hot the FCA are on commissions. They're looking at those historic ones and into the discretionary finance commission payments paid to dealers. And I think this is just the latest thing that they're clamping down on. They've told us they have no intention of banning gap insurance as a product line. However, what I've heard they have asked is for insurance companies who provide gap insurance to withdraw them from the market voluntarily from February the 7th, which means that it's effectively a ban, but not in name. So they are going to be investigating these products further and to see where there is value and if there is value. I think personally, gap insurance actually does do a good thing for customers. Mm. But I think equally, I can understand why the FCA are investigating, because those commission payments are quite high. I think reading between the lines, the FCA wants consumers to still be able to buy these products, but probably do them directly from the insurance providers at much less commissions to do so. But yeah, I mean, you can imagine this story broke about half an hour ago, and the website has gone crazy with people reading this story, because gap insurance makes up a very large proportion of F&I sales that dealers make. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it looks a bit worrying, this one.
I'm a little bit torn on this, because obviously it's a big money spinner. On the other hand, as a consumer, when I've been in dealers and I've been offered it, it is the price that I've been offered in particular dealers has always taken me aback by how much I assume how, you know, either this is a very expensive product or there's an enormous amount of markup on it. And I think it's probably the latter. That said, we're talking about the figures we're talking about here is probably £500 for a gap policy maximum. Yeah, something like that, isn't it?
£500.
Yeah, that's not a huge amount of money in the grand scheme of things. Whereas if you were, you know, I know we're talking about this in the terms of the PPI scandal and all this sort of stuff, aren't we? I would imagine that the payouts from things like that are much higher than anything like this. I mean, you could kind of say, if you've been missold gap insurance, how much are you actually going to get back from that, if you see what I mean? I don't think you've missold a huge amount of product if you have been missold anything. I think the big, it's such comparatively low value for them to be panicking about this is how
I don't think it's a missale though, John.
I don't think it is. But I'm just using that as a context. If it's something that the FCA are worried about, that the consumers are not getting good value, it's not a huge amount actually. And realistically, I think people are expected to go in and haggle and say, well, I don't really want gap insurance at £500, and then it happily the price comes down a bit. It's just my overriding point is, where does it end? I know it's a regulated product, but at what point do you have to let car dealers get on and sell the things that they need to sell and understand that there are margins attached to everything in a car dealership or any retail environment, and not be completely.
And the other thing to mention is, 50% commission might be high, but I'm sure consumers in many other industries are paying large premiums where there is very large markups that are not being investigated. I do feel at times car dealers are seen as an easy target.
Yeah.
Shall we ask a car dealer what he thinks?
Yeah, James. Tom.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say with GAP, we actually don't sell it. We took the decision about three years ago not to sell it because we felt like it was a lot. It's actually a lot of work doing a GAP policy, and the paperwork and the regulation is, there's so many things you have to do it in a certain way, and a lot of our customers didn't really want it anyway, but we felt you can get caught out a lot easier doing it, that the upside was pretty minimal, to be honest. So whilst I do think it is a great product for the consumers, you know, for us, it obviously having a ban makes no difference. But I do think possibly the dealers are entitled to some sort of markup, because it is actually, there's quite a lot that goes into it. I remember thinking, God, it's a bit of a nightmare actually even offering GAP, because there's so many things you have to do. So, you know, it's not as straightforward as just here's a form and sign it. There's quite a lot of regulation around it.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Okie dokie. I'm going to jump us over to Geneva.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, we've got two sort of Geneva stories here. This is our colleague, was it Ted, went and had a chat to the boss of Geneva Motor Show. So the first one I've got is Geneva Motor Show could appear in more countries despite not going down too well in Qatar. Well, I didn't go down very well in the press here that it went to Qatar, because Qatar as a country is not very warm and cuddly, and a lot of people, myself included, didn't really love that Geneva had shacked itself up there.
And hasn't got a city called Geneva for a start.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not quite sure how this is going to, I mean, what is the Geneva Motor Show going to come to, like, Battersea or New York? Or like, it's weird. I don't really get it. But they seem confident that it could work in a few more places. Not really sure how they've reached that confidence, because the second story that I come to is, who is actually at the Geneva Motor Show this year in Geneva? So this is the first year that it has returned to the actual place that it's named after. Coincidentally, it's 100 years since it became the Geneva International Motor Show this year. Sadly, it's not going to be a very nice anniversary for them, because I've got the full list of manufacturers who are going there. Would you like to hear them, James? I'm sure you know them already.
I don't.
Okay. Renault.
Right.
MG.
Yep.
BYD.
Yeah.
And Lucid.
Is that it?
Well, no, there's Dacia as well, but I didn't really
care. Okay. I mean, that's going to be an empty hall, isn't it?
So, yeah, it's not ideal. It's not ideal. And it's such a shame, because Geneva used to be kind of like, you have your Parises and you have your Frankfurts, and you get the French manufacturers love Paris and the Germans love Frankfurt or Munich or wherever it is now. And Geneva used to be kind of like, one, it used to be supercar.
Yeah.
Own, really, didn't it? And the second thing is, it used to kind of get everyone together in one place. So the French ones would still appear, the Germans would still appear, and so on. Doesn't seem to be happening here. Nobody's bothering to actually attend, which is a bit of a shame. Yeah. I mean, I was looking at this list of manufacturers, and I was thinking, I was in Westfield in West London the other day, shopping centre, and there are more cars in there than there will be in this Geneva Motor Show. I saw four different like stands or little mini dealerships in shop fronts and so on. So I just can't see how this is going to work for them. But they've got themselves into a very difficult scenario now, because our colleague Ted interviewed various people from Geneva their chief executive, Sandro Mesquita, he said, it's clear that the 2024 edition is more compact. talking of the show there, not of a car. He said it's
so
not
compact. It could be in a hotel room.
Well, yeah. But he's still blaming. Well, he says COVID has accelerated some changes, but I just think we're beyond.
It's such a shame, isn't it? I mean, I used to love the Geneva Motor Show, not least because we could go skiing at the same time, but also it was just such a brilliant show. And as I can see what you're doing here, as usual, playing to your audience. But the supercar element of Geneva used to be amazing. I remember the last one I went to, Aston Martin had a. They did that huge fanfare of all these different Aston Martins they were going to launch that we've never actually seen. Mm. Ferrari had, you used to have Ferrari, Lamborghini, Bugatti. They used to all do huge launches and always have a special car for the Geneva Motor Show. Tom, I bet you went every year, didn't you?
I've definitely been a few times, and it was always, yeah, the whole, we used to always go in the morning, have a wild kind of frenzy of a day, trying to get on different stands and seeing as many cars possible. And then we'd fly back in the evening. It was always a chaotic day, but it was a lot of fun. And yeah, the main thing was to see all these big reveals. And, you know, it was the biggest event, really. And yeah, to hear there's only those brands, those manufacturers doing it is very sad.
Are you saying you won't bother going to see the new MG3, the small hatchback?
Yeah, I think I might pass on that one.
Oh, wow.
Do you think they're important motor shows? I mean, we obviously haven't had them for the last few years. Do you think it matters to car sales? Clearly not, I suppose.
I don't know. I wouldn't have thought so. I think online is clearly where people are going to get their news. It's just... Everyone likes going to a big event, don't they? I mean, we've obviously still got Festival of Speed. I guess that's our big version of, you know, getting all the manufacturers and, you know, millions of cars together. But yeah, Geneva was just a nice thing to go to. So it's just a sad, you know, sad to see it sort of diminish.
Yeah, real shame. Right, I am going to move us on, John, if you don't mind, to a story about tax.
Great.
Yeah, we love a tax story. No, but this is the car dealer world's biggest taxpayers have been revealed this morning in the Sunday Times tax list, which has been published on a Friday.
Where were you, 10th?
No, just outside the top 100, John, just outside the top 100. But who do you think was top? Can you guess?
Was it Lady Clark?
It was Lady Clark. How much do you think she handed over to the tax man in 2023 in pounds sterling?
Well, I don't know. More than Cafe Nero.
You're probably right. Probably more than Amazon. £78.3 million check was written to HMRC for her tax bill last year. She was by far and away the largest car dealer taxpayer. Next on the list was Douglas Park and family, 18 million. The Tordoff family, JCT 600, paid £17.4 million. Then you got Richard and Christine Teatham of Stoneacre, £16.7 million. Jeffrey Warren of car giant fame, £14.7 million. Peter Lovett of Dick Lovett, £14.3 million handed over to the tax man. Then you've got Mark and Rhiannon Bailey, who are behind Trade Center Group, what's Trade Center Wales, £13.9 million. And then Graham Day and family, £10.2 million handed over to the taxpayer. So some very successful businesses there, because if you're not successful, you don't pay tax.
The big one for me there is Car Giant, because that's still one site, isn't it?
Yep.
Unless he has, I'm sure he has other investments, but still.
Amazing profession.
Yeah. A lot of multi-franchised places. Cool.
Yeah. Where was Lady Clark on the list? Because it was a top 100. She was, just reading the story really quickly, 15th place overall out of the UK's biggest taxpayers.
Yikes.
Which is pretty impressive, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that is. I mean, it goes to show, number one, how many people haven't moved to Monaco. And number two, how many dealer groups are still privately owned.
Yeah.
At least, majority, you know, there's still private investment in them.
For the moment.
At least, and so on, yeah.
Yeah. Right, well, that's my story. That's my story. Back to you.
Very good. I'm assuming Tom doesn't particularly want to comment on you in the list, Tom.
No comment.
I can't imagine we're in that list, but we certainly pay a lot of tax.
We look forward to seeing you there in future. We'll move on to Stellantis. So I've got a bit of a weird story with Stellantis, only because, no offence to John Bowman that wrote this, but it's sort of news, but isn't. So Stellantis have expanded their, as John Bowman's put it, its used car sales potential in the UK with the launch of Spotty Car Direct. Mm. The thing I found slightly confusing by this is that actually this came out like 6 months ago. But I think what's happened is Stellantis have realized that no one was using it and have issued another press release about it, and perhaps made some tweaks to the service. But anyway, the basic gist of this is that they've launched as part of their used car locator that you might find in any other multi-franchisee company like Stellantis. You can now go on and there are cars direct to have from Stellantis. But not really direct to buy straight from Stellantis. You can only then send it to a dealer and then you buy it from the dealer. But the reason I bring this up is because I was actually a bit disappointed by it. Because you hear direct to consumer. Well, it's not direct to consumer, but you hear things like this about buying online. You think, oh, it's another kazoo. You know, they're coming out of the woodwork. Lots of more, another cinch rival. It's not really another cinch rival. And I think they perhaps need to go back to the drawing board a little bit and work a little bit harder on there. And I say that because I've gone on, and one of the things that was drilled into us at our Auto Trader meeting, James, was pictures. Take lots and lots and lots of pictures. Show everything to the consumer. They don't really do that. There's 15 photos. You can't really determine anything about the car from these 15 photos. Really low res, taken from about 15 feet away. One of them I just went on to has like they've taken a photo of the dash of this mocker advertised at 22 grand and it said system failure, traction battery error.
Oh God.
So I think what's happened here is that it's not really being operated by people trying to sell cars. It's being operated by their preparation center in Corby, who I don't really think know quite what they're doing. But one of the other things I wanted to talk about is who's determining the price of these cars? So when I go on there and look at my mocker for 19 grand, who's decided it's 19 grand? Stellantis have decided it's 19 grand. So then what happens when I actually buy it? Does it then, the dealer has to honor that particular price, presumably, that Stellantis have, and where's the, who gets a bit of margin? Is this sort of like a strange agency-ish? I don't really get it.
Really.
It is.
And these online used car sales haven't gone exactly well, have they?
No, they haven't. And I don't think they have, you know, if any were going to go well, it would have been Cazoo, because Cazoo spend a lot of time describing the cars and you get all these little guides with if there's any damage and all this sort of stuff. Doesn't seem to be happening on this particular thing. And it is so devoid of, I hate to keep having a go at it, but it is so devoid of information in terms of there's no information here about what the service history of the car is, no information about whether it's got any damage, anything like that. And you get, I don't know, maybe 10 words about the car itself, you know, like next MOT due then, clean bodywork, interior, clean. That's it. That's all it says. I wouldn't buy a car from it is all I'm saying. So Stellantis, if you're listening, try harder. It's not that difficult.
Well, you'll be able to speak to Nicola Dobson because she's coming to car new life, Johnson.
I will make a point of saying, I'm sorry, Nicola, it's not quite going to work for you, I'm afraid. So if perhaps you're struggling, I can tell you why.
I don't think we should ask Tom what he thinks of Spotty Car, but I will ask him about online car sales because I'm fascinated to think whether people go onto his website and send him all the money for a Ferrari SF90.
Yeah, in terms of actually like buying it direct from the website, we don't do that. I think if you're going to sell cars like that online direct, you know, you've got to give them as much information as possible and just overload them to the point where they don't need to come to a dealership or call anyone even. But yeah, it's not for us. You know, we do sell cars blind. Wouldn't really call it an online sale, but there's definitely people who just look at a car on a website. They know us, so they'll just send the money, get the car delivered. So yeah, it kind of works in that way, but it's still, there's still a phone call, there's still, you know, at least emails going back and forth, and you know, it's never as straightforward on this level of cars just to be like, you know, click a button and buy a car.
And that's a lot to do with trust, isn't it? That they trust you and know you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to let you know about our brilliant event we've got coming up on March the 7th. It's called Car Dealer Live 2024, and it takes place at the British Motor Museum at Gaydon. Well, we'll have a packed day of sessions to help car dealers, just like you, improve your business. Tickets are available now at cardealerlive.co.uk with a special rate for car dealers. On the day, I'll have headline interviews with franchise car dealer boss Peter Vardy and Big Motor in World Group's Peter Wardell. To find out more and book your tickets, visit cardealerlive.co.uk now. Right, back to the podcast. Right, I will move us on to another story. And I have lost it because I started looking at your one. No, I have picked the story that we also published today. Very busy news day on Friday. This is news from Lookers.
I knew it would be.
More Lookers news, this time not about redundancies, but about their owners are out there fishing to refinance that very, very painful amount of money they borrowed to fund that Lookers deal. So Global Auto Holdings are the Canadian business behind that acquisition of Lookers. They paid £504.2 million for Lookers in the UK. They did that with funding from three Canadian banks, and that is due to expire 12 months after that acquisition was sealed. And now we've heard from sources that they are out there fishing for new finance. They're desperate to get hold of a new funding line. And the sources we spoke to said this is mostly because this is why we're seeing these redundancies and this cost cutting. That money that they borrowed originally is at a very painful interest rate. At 10% is obviously £50 million. And Lookers made pre-tax profits in 2022, £84.4 million. So that tax, that interest payment alone is wiping out a large proportion of Lookers' profit at the moment. So they obviously need to refinance it. But the interesting thing on this one is apparently they are having to wrap in the Canadian business, which is very successful, turns over about $1 billion last accounts and makes about 100 million EBITDA profit. So they're having to wrap it all into one big package, one big deal to refinance the whole lot. So having to effectively put up the Canadian business as collateral to finance the Lookers business here. So yeah, obviously it hasn't been done, the deal hasn't been done, but they're out there looking for fresh finance, and that's why we're seeing these painful moves that they're making here with regards to redundancies.
Question I would ask here is, was it all worth it? Not really. Like to do it in this way, they've wiped out not half the staff, but they've made a lot of staff redundant. It's not got a good vibe anymore, Lookers, has it, from an employee point of view, and probably not from a customer point of view when people wander in there. And for all that, they're now struggling to refinance it and are having to leverage it against their other business. It just seems like such a poor decision to make. It'd be a bit like me saying, okay, well, I've heard that SF90 is a really good investment, but all I can do is, well, my Barclay card's got a good limit. You know, maybe I can spread it across that and another one and another one and another one and another one. And then shockingly enough, a year later, still lost money. How's that happened? I don't understand this. It was supposed to go up in value. Oh yeah, well, your interest rate is way beyond what he's ever going to make. Every time we write something about this, it just is so disappointing that it could have gone a different way.
Yeah,
and hundreds of people would not have been made redundant, probably, and its future would not be looking quite so in jeopardy.
It'll be interesting to see how the other deals pan out, isn't it? The Pendragon one being bought by a very different business,
yeah,
for cash, so no funding needed whatsoever. It'll be interesting to see how they manage that business here in the UK. and whether it's just a completely different, it's just different ways of doing things, or whether it's a more of a stateside way of running businesses that we're seeing the effects of over here. We haven't seen anything with Jardine, have we? When Lithia purchased Jardine, it's all been very quiet on that front. So maybe it just is the way that this deal has gone through with Lookers. Very disappointing.
Right. I'll move us on, shall I then?
Yes, please do.
What shall I go for? I am going to choose not an Australia story. I'm going to talk about a story we've got that says the UK has been revealed to be the most transparent country for people to buy a used car. It's according to research from Car Vertical, I believe, which is a sort of like used car history checker and all this sort of stuff. But they're mainly European based, aren't they? I can't remember where they started, but more towards Eastern Europe. And apparently we are the best place to buy a used car, even though almost a fifth of our secondhand cars have a damage marker against them. Part of that apparently comes from the fact that we do not import many cars, I would imagine, because we have the steering wheel on the correct side and everyone else doesn't. Whereas across Europe, I think when we chatted to their founder boss, he sort of said a lot of cars in Europe, well, it kind of goes in one direction, doesn't it? They tend to go from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, I remember him telling us. But there's a lot more movement of vehicles around in Europe, as you'd expect, because you can drive it over a border and put a new number plate on it. And if it was cheaper in France than it is in Slovakia, then you've done quite well, haven't you, to drive it a few hundred miles there. But yes, so apparently we're pretty good in the grand scheme of things. So James, when we, you know, go and look at Mazda 6s and find that they're ruined, actually it could be a lot worse.
It could be a lot worse. And oh God, and that sounds horrendous. I don't know sometimes how it could be any worse. But that is, I think that's quite positive to see.
It is positive, isn't it?
Yeah, most honest.
I mean, Tom, you must buy internationally a little bit. How do you kind of, it's, I mean, obviously for James, it's nice and easy. He runs things through his Experian check and everything comes back rosy. But how do you go about verifying that McLaren or whatever has not been completely ruined across the pond in where it's been living?
We actually very, very rarely buy from outside the UK. It is every time we have bought a car from Europe or even Far East, is definitely very nervy and it always feels a bit dodgy in a way. You just kind of like, you can't check things out as you can in the UK. I mean, with the UK, you've got HPI, DVLA, those are actually quite good systems when you compare it to what, you know, when you try and do the similar checks in Europe, like they don't have things like that. Someone like compare our V5 document with some of like the French and some of like, we bought a car from Poland and they come with like barely any information. Obviously some of it's in a different language, which is already a bit of a hurdle. And it just feels safer buying in the UK always. You know, and yeah, they don't seem to service their cars as much as we do here, I find. We kind of steer clear. And to be honest, most cars abroad are more expensive now. So the UK is actually pretty good value compared to most countries. So it's not really worth it for us.
That's interesting, because there was a time when it was, well, I think it's probably for stock older than what you would.
It used to be 7 or 8 years ago, we were actively looking to buy cars abroad because there were stronger prices in the UK, but it's completely flipped.
Interesting. So, is it flipped from your customer's point of view? Have you got more international buyers now than perhaps where you were stronger here?
Exactly. Yeah. So we're doing actually more export. And really, we're talking about just the really higher end stuff because, you know, as you said, right hand drive, there's not many places they can go. For the really special stuff where it might be a one of one, you will get foreign overseas buyers. We've sold quite a few cars to Dubai and places like that. So yeah, we're definitely seeing it. The bad thing for us is that we're probably not going to see those cars again. We'd always rather sell to our own customers in the UK because you can buy them back, possibly do finance. So as soon as they go abroad, you're kind of like, that's the last we'll ever see of that one.
Interesting.
Worth remembering, James, if anyone phones you up for that Fiesta that you've just purchased, you want to keep it in the Gosport area. So yeah.
Thank you.
No problem.
I have got one more story, John, and then I am done. And this is an update from used car supermarket Motorpoint, funnily enough, from today. I told you it'd been a busy morning. They've issued a trading update for the third quarter, their third quarter. And worryingly, they say profit for the year is likely now to be down 5 to 6 million below previous expectations. So they are looking at quite a whopping loss coming up for this year. They said that this is down to price corrections. And we've well reported on those over the last quarter of 2023, those price falls in the trade market and actually at retail level. And they were also, they say, disrupted quite heavily by their Derby stores' temporary closure as a result of those Storm Babette floods that happened and obviously caused a lot of damage. They are anticipating, they say, a strong final quarter, but they did warn that their average selling price of cars has fallen from nearly £20,000 to £14,500 as a result of changing its stock mix and moving away from the volatile higher priced vehicles. But just in terms of a quote from them, they said the macroeconomic conditions remained difficult in quarter three and were further compounded by the sharp falls in used car values and reduced selling prices. They said they are making some momentum in the new quarter and volumes are now growing year on year. They've remained closely controlling their costs, they say, and they've got further savings achieved in people costs, always a worry, and efficiencies resulting from technology investment. Not a happy ship over there at Motorpoint, is it? I mean, they're having some real trouble, and it just shows you that some of these large used car supermarkets that are really at risk of these big falls are going to be suffering. It'll be interesting to see how the others cope with this. We haven't had updates from Cazoo, have we, on the last quarter?
I'm sure they're fine.
I'm sure they're fine. They probably put it on their Barclay card, John, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. But yeah, this is a worry. And I think we're probably going to see quite a bit more of this over the next few weeks and months.
Yeah, I mean, this is not I feel like we were talking about this probably 6 months ago, and it was a similar sort of situation. It's that bit of the market, isn't it? The way that they operate has worked for a very long time, but I suppose this is purely down to their what they thought they were going to earn and haven't. But you know, the way that they operate and the things that they sell and the margins that they work off obviously is getting pretty thin, isn't it? Whereas you to look at Big Motoring World, another big car supermarket, doesn't really buy the same sort of stuff as Motorpoint, does it? They're much more invested in buying stuff and then prepping it quite a bit. I guess it's very hard for Motorpoint at this point, which would have just made its money from buying pretty clean stock, ex-lease stuff, usually buying loads and loads of defleeted stuff and selling it on quickly. That's not really working at the minute, is it? Because lease companies are holding on to stuff for a bit longer. Nobody's servicing anything apparently at the minute. It's just a very tricky bit of the market to operate in, I think.
Shore Capital, the brokers, issued a bulletin after those results this morning, and they're estimating now profit before tax for Motorpoint will be a pre-tax loss between £6 and £9 million for this year. Mm. You know, and actually, this was a very profitable business not very long ago. I mean, that is going to be painful, very painful. Tom, do you look at some of these big used car supermarket groups and think, thank God I'm not doing that?
Definitely. I know they can be incredibly profitable. I always think, God, the amount of work that must go into it, the amount of people. But yeah, interesting to hear that. And I think, yeah, so many people announced record profits over the last year or two. And I think, yeah, when we're going to see 2023's results, I think a lot of people are going to be down. It'd be a pretty impressive business to be up on the sort of 2022 and 2021.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's me out of stories, John.
Well, I am also out of stories. So, Tom, before we ask for your verdict, are there any stories you think we've missed this week?
As far as industry news, No, I mean, you guys know, you know, I don't follow every story, but I always follow your newsletters and read, you know, read the ones that catch my eye. I mean, the only thing that came out, you know, I look at car releases, the Porsche Macan EV being announced yesterday, I thought has created a bit of a stir in our sector because people think it looks horrible.
I like it.
And you kind of, most people I've spoken to are like, it looks just a bit overly aggressive to what should be like a clean electric car. But I don't know. It's good to hear that there's some positive people.
It's a bit out of my price range, though. So, I mean, I'm not really the target audience.
Don't get me started on electric cars.
Oh, we did so well.
Guess what, though? I'll tell you what. Just a little bit of news for you. I had an email this morning from the House of Lords. Funny enough, you know, they've done this investigation. They had this big consultation.
What, into your Audi?
Not into my Audi, but into the EV market. Well, they're going to report on that in the next week. Actually, I think it comes out on the 6th of February. And they've offered me an interview with Baroness Parmiter, who conducted that investigation. And I'm going to be doing that on the 5th. So I'll be able to ask her why it's been very hard for me to charge my Audi, and also why I only did 200 miles.
You realise the Baroness is not the customer service rep for Podpoint. You understand that, right?
Well, she might as well be when I am talking to her on that.
Anyway, thrilling as that is, James. Tom, I'm going to have to ask you, who do you think chose the big stories? Which were your favourites?
It was close. Obviously, the Gap story was interesting. And the Geneva story was interesting. But for me, the fact that there was a positive story about the UK being the most transparent place to buy a car would give John the edge for me.
Oh, well done, John. Well done.
Take that win. Thank you very much. You can come back, Tom.
About time you won one.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, all that's left for me to say is thank you to Tom for judging today. It's been lovely to have you on. And I'm sure we'll see you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure.
Nice to see you. Thanks, Tom.
And thank you as well to James for, well, I've written here, thank you to James for not moaning about electric cars this week, but you've ruined that. So
sorry.
Sorry about that, everyone. But thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories you've mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.